entry, OHSU is well positioned to take a leadership role in this emerging industry. This will have far-reaching effects on quality of health care and access to the latest medical advances in communities throughout Oregon. It also will create thousands of high-paying jobs, not just in Portland, but in many other areas throughout the state where biomedical research will take place. So thank you again, Mr. Chairman, for your courtesies, and I really appreciate the opportunity to just share with you my experience with OHSU and Peter Kohler in this last 6 years, and I've talked to Senator Hatfield a lot about OHSU. Of course, that's his favorite project, and although he's no longer a U.S. senator, he has a lot of influence, impact on bringing in the private research funds, and so I think that this 21st century and this first session of this new century, why, if we do the things in higher education that we have the opportunity to do, and very specifically to OHSU and the Oregon opportunity, why, it's going to be a very good session. It's going to be a very good century. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I just could comment while Senator Hartung is here, and he's heard me say this, and several others of you may have heard me say it too, but it's amazing the number of committees I've been involved where OHSU has come into play. But just a little bit of history, when he was talking about years ago when there was a possibility, would OHSU even exist at this point? And my story really tells you how things were at that particular time. Back when Oregon was trying to get the Saturn plant into the state, I went on a private jet with Governor Attia, and on that same trip was Bud Davis, who was the Chancellor of Higher Education at that time. And Bud and I were playing gin rummy or something on the plane as we flew back to Detroit. And the stakes at that particular point, I was dealing with the Rajneesh. He was having the problem with OHSU, and we were playing to see who had to take the other's problems. And now, can you imagine OHSU being considered a problem nowadays? Because, you know, when you think about it, and frankly, I give the good president and the foresight of, again, Senator Hartung and some others, just when you think of where it was just about 13 years ago, and where it is today, and the potential of the world class, and we keep using that terminology, it's there. And as I traveled around the state during this interim, we were on the rural health tour, it was just amazing. And I didn't even bring it up, but it came up every place we went. We could be in LeGrand, we could be in John Day, any place, and people would comment about, we could not survive these days without the kind of help we're getting from OHSU. And I think that speaks to the outreach concept that the president and his staff have taken as seeing themselves as an Oregon institution. And I think it's just amazing because I've watched that transition. And I just, I think the great foresight at that time in making that move, and of course, the smart move of bringing Dr. Kohler in and the staff he's put together, I think it's just phenomenal. And I just want to kind of get that on the record in this future group, since we're going to be hearing those budgets. It's amazing.
I thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, for listening to me. And
well, there's another Oregon institution sitting back there in one of the back rows. Is he here to testify?
Who would that be?
Well, that former co-chair, that former Young Svelte co-chair from Burns Oregon.
Senator Timms would be very appropriate for him to talk.
Since we're getting the history, did you want to come now, Jim?
The history?
All right. He is full of it.
Paying my due respect.
Well, excuse me, what was his name again? He comes in and tries to commandeer my office all the time. Just
I don't. Well, he does the same thing to mine.
He had my office, and he still thinks it's his. And I just have a hard time.
Well, thank you. What an honor to be here and following the good Senator Hartung. For the record, my name is Gene Timms, state senator, or used to be, from District 30, now the person that fights for a parking lot every day. It's a privilege for me to be here. and testify for the Oregon Health Sciences University. As you know, most of you know, I had the public corporation bill that made them a public corporation, Senate Bill 2. And ever since then, I have been amazed, and I haven't been amazed at government totally, but I've been amazed at the Oregon Health Sciences University and what they've been able to accomplish, which you alluded to. When we first approached the Oregon Health Sciences University, Dr. Lasser was there, and we wanted some help in rural areas, and he says, forget it. We are a Portland school operation, and we will not do that. When Peter Kohler came, things changed tremendously. In fact, I still say I think this man, that's why he's dear in my heart, is sincere when he works for rural areas. Doesn't just come out of his mouth. He practices it. And I have loved that. I've loved being part of it. I'm glad they let me be part of it. Could have been anybody. Could have had the privilege that I had, which probably gave me a little credibility around here if I ever had any. But I tell you, it's been a privilege, an honor, and I think everything that we can do for them, everything, naturally. I've said on that side, too. But the same token, they should get special credit for everything that they have done. And I don't know if each one of you got a little synopsis of what they've done for your county. My editor of the paper in Burns drug it out at a community pride meeting, and it went through everything that they had done in Harney County, and I believe they put that out in every county in the state, and they are good at letting people know, but the same token, many departments do not do that. I do not think there is a institution, and when we got them out of higher ed, it's the best thing we ever did, because higher ed is a mess. I'm sorry. They are tough to get to their budget, and it's tough to get to. When we got them out, it made a difference, because we separated the two, because they're a different animal than the others. And I think it's been very, very successful, and I would encourage you to enhance or improve this opportunity that we have, because I believe they will handle it properly. Thank you very much. You probably wouldn't have called on me, Mr. Chair.
No comment.
But thank you very
much. Let you finish.
I have a question.
Oh, my favorite senator.
Okay. Senator Tim, can you tell us what are the primary programs that OHSU has done for rural health?
Well, I think the primary program you'd probably look at would be nursing.
Mm-hmm.
That they control the nursing in Eastern Oregon College, or OIT, and in the colleges that teach in those areas. One of the biggest, and the biggest privilege that I ever got, was the dedication of the primary care center in Klamath Falls, with Senator Hatfield, which has put doctors in rural areas in residency. When I came here in 1983, we had one doctor in Burns. Now we have six. We have two nurse practitioners. If anything, we've held in rural areas, and rural areas are in worse shape now than they were when I started. But we are in good shape medically. We are in good shape with education. And I think the Oregon Health Sciences University has made that happen.
Mr. Chair, could I add one thing? I think in answer to her question, too, as we went around, it was noticeable that in the training program for the MD program, there is the rotation for the family practice physicians. They spend, and I forget the exact number, how long they spend out in the rural areas, but they actually move out and they live in those areas, and they do part of their residency in rural health. So they've really, that's just a part of the whole program now. Yes, they're students. Yeah, they're students who are in what, third year medical school, and then the residents too. So those people are out there working and on the scene. And the other thing too was the you alluded to about the nurse training. In my day, the community colleges, you know, came under my jurisdiction, and I had the constant battle between, in those days, we had the three-year nursing programs, you had the community college two-year nursing programs, then you had the four-year nursing programs. And I can assure you, they did not have respect for one another at all. It was just a constant battle. And now, and I was in Dr. Kohler's office, and we're dealing with the dean of the nursing school, and there's a great working relationship now with community colleges, and they say, hey, wait a minute, we need nurses. We're all players in this whole thing. So that, you know, you never want to say all turf battles are resolved, but it certainly is a much, much better state today than it was, I know, 15 years ago. That was just absolutely, I mean, just mind-boggling. I had to sit in the middle of it all the time, and you could never win.
One other place, and then I'll be quiet. Area Health Education Centers, which I believe have been instrumental in educating people in rural areas about the importance of health care. And I think their future is even more important, because health care is probably one of the biggest issues we have, and it's the big gorilla that's tough to get to. And we got to have some people out there that have the ability to explain what actually is happening in those areas, and the Area Health Education Center program, it's been a great program. You can go on. There's more than that. The Poison Center does a lot of great things in rural Oregon. It's amazing what they've done in a little old county of 7,000 people like Harney County. So I'm a big believer in the Oregon Health Sciences University, and hope they keep up doing the kind of job they've done in the past.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I know you have limited time today, and I don't want to take up too much of the time from OHSU's presentation, but I'd like to very briefly just let you know that I have distributed an item on your desk in front of you today. It's a memo that includes some information about OHSU that I think you might find helpful. And I would just like to say a few words about how OHSU is funded, what the state's role is in that funding, and how the institution is operating now that it's a public corporation. Because the OHSU is now a public corporation and not a state agency, the Ways and Means role is quite different than it is for a state agency, because the legislature does not approve the OHSU budget. That budget is approved by the hospital's board of directors, or the university's, I should say, board of directors. What the legislature does, though, is to provide, or has been providing, general fund support to assist the institution with its education, healthcare, and public service activities. The grants amount that the state has been providing OHSU, if you look in the packet that I've distributed, and you flip over a page and just look at the charts there, you can see that the general fund support that OHSU has received from the state, the first bar shows $125 million. That was the last biennium before OHSU became a public corporation. After OHSU was made a public corporation in 95, that general fund support declined by about 14%, down to about $106 million. And if you follow it since then, you can see that the 2001-03 number is what's being proposed in the governor's budget. That would include general fund support that's actually lower than what was provided in 95, although not shown on this diagram is another $10 million in support for OHSU's new programs, not their existing programs, but the new programs that would come from tobacco revenue bonds. The second chart just shows that adjusted for inflation, the general fund support has declined 31% since OHSU became a public corporation. So the proposed budget will be difficult on OHSU's continuing of its existing programs that it has been funding with support of the state. But the state's support level only represent about 7% of OHSU's budget. So it's a very small portion. The majority of OHSU's funds comes from patient revenues and fees for services to patients at the hospitals and clinics that OHSU operates. Unless there are additional questions, I think Mr. Friels is prepared to talk about the governor's recommended budget for OHSU.
Mr. Chairman, I have a quick question for Steve. The last column here, $104.7 million for 0103, but actually is $114,694,000. You didn't include the $10 million from this tobacco litigation money?
Yes, Senator. That was what I was saying, that there is an additional $10 million of tobacco revenue funds for new programs at OHSU in the governor's budget.
So I guess my question is, why didn't you include it in this column?
The reason I could have. Let me start by saying that way. The reason why, though, I didn't was that the general fund has been, because OHSU is a public corporation, we don't look at any other funds in their budget. Since they become a public corporation, we look at the general fund support. So I did include the general fund support. I could have, you're correct, included the additional $10 million as well.
It looks better.
It would look
better. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, Kelly Friels with the Department of Administrative Services. Good afternoon. You should have my handout before you, and I'm going to go through them very quickly given the amount of time we have. Let me start with page 2, and Steve has pretty much identified that the total budget that the governor is recommending for this organization is $114.7 million, the vast majority of that being general fund for operating the public purpose portion of this organization, and then $10 million for debt service related to the Oregon Opportunity Fund. Just to give you some perspective, I don't know if my numbers are exactly right, but if you consider that this organization is about $700 million a year, the amount of resources the state puts in is around 7%, to give you some relative scale. Moving to page 3 of the handout, looking at funding sources again. The vast majority of it is general fund, and then we have the $10 million that Steve pointed out is from the tobacco settlement fund. That total fund is a little under $350 million, so this is a very small piece of that. Moving to page 4, just reiterating that the governor did not finance this organization at the current service level. They're $10 million below, which is roughly about a 6% reduction from the current program level. If you would fund them at that and use those funds to continue the or to start up the Oregon Opportunity Fund with, again, tobacco settlement resources. Page 5 gives you the same information that Steve provided. I did include the $10 million if you look at 2001-2003, so Senator Yee can look either Steve's or mine, depending on which display she wants to look at it, but it still gives you the same picture that compared especially to the 91-93 biennium, resources have been lower overall since that period, even though they're rising slightly. And the next slide, which should be 6, I wanted to give you some perspective of how the state resources are used, and I went back to the documents for Oregon Health and Science University, and for fiscal year 2000-2001, they broke out their budget by these particular program areas that I'm sure Dr. Kohler will talk to you about later, but just to point out that 26% of the resources, state resources, were spent on the School of Medicine and 25% were on the Hospital Subsidy for Public Mission, and you can see some of the other categories. It gives you some idea of how they were spent in the past, how they will be spent in the future will probably change depending on how this organization would like to allocate these resources. Page 7 and 8 just really go through the basic building blocks of this budget. This is fairly simple. Increase the standard inflation by 2.5%. We reduced the budget by $10 million from a service level and use those resources using tobacco settlement funds for the Oregon Opportunity Fund. So with that, Mr. Chair, real briefly, is that the governor's budget? Be happy to answer any questions.
Certainly. In terms of in the policy packages, the funding for the biotech, how did you calculate $10 million generates $200 million in funding revenue?
And Mr. Chair, this budget doesn't assume that they will get $200 million in bonding capacity. The governor's position is that there was $10 million available for debt service, and they'd have to fund it within those resources. So it would be less than $200 million.
And do you know how much $10 million?
Mr. Chair, no, I do not.
Any other questions? Representative Lowe.
No, I guess I have a general question. I'm not sure if I should be asking you or if I should wait for Dr. Kohler, but I'm concerned about any shortfalls that OHSU might be suffering and how they might be making it up from their other funds that they receive specifically for, and I understand that the bulk of that comes from patient care. OHSU over the years has been famous for serving the indigent population, and there's a growing number of those in the metro area and from around the state that are relying on OHSU for services. Will OHSU have to change its patient profile, and will there be fewer services for the indigent population?
Mr. Chair,
as of the funding recommendation.
Yeah, Representative Lowe, I can't answer that question. We did explore when we were building the governor's budget what options were available for difference in financing, and although we had several conversations, we really did not get to a distinct plan. I think they were going to take that to their board and make some decisions depending on what the legislature did. But I think Dr. Kohler could probably give you a little better idea.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you. Dr. Kohler.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Peter Kohler, President of Oregon Health and Science University. And my task this afternoon is really to provide some overview of OHSU and what it does. And I think the specific questions with regard to budget cuts, I can take some now, or these can be filled in as we go along through the academic programs and through the clinical programs. You've heard a little bit of testimony about Senate Bill 2, it was 6 years ago, that created OHSU as a public corporation. I can't underestimate how important a step I think that was. Academic health centers have been increasingly living in a hostile environment with regard to reimbursement situations, and as you are aware, we have struggled with the bottom line and fulfilling our mission of taking care of the poor, and we are the largest provider of care for the poor, Medicaid and indigent in the state. The Senate Bill 2 provided us as a public corporation. It identified a board which was able to make decisions in a simple manner, and frankly, I think has been a very important key to our success. But I'd like to sort of go through some steps with you. And you have somewhere, I think, a book that looks like this, which is a fact book that recently was provided. And if you don't have one, there are a couple of diagrams in there that I'd like to allude to. The other thing which you may or may not have is a book that looks like this. This is called the Blue Ridge Academic Health Group. It's their first report. I'm a member of that group. And it's an academic think tank looking at the survival of academic health centers and trying to figure out what could be done to improve the environment. And frankly, I can tell you the summary of that was that academic health centers really have to operate in a much more business-like and accountable way. And we think that is, in fact, what has occurred since we became a public corporation. More than half of institutions such as ourselves have been in serious financial trouble. Some have sold their hospitals. Many have done that, frankly, to get rid of the responsibility for taking care of the poor. Others have declared bankruptcy or some combination. They've merged with each other. And some have just gone to the state and asked for more money. I was very interested recently in talking to somebody from the University of California, San Diego, which had been running a large deficit, and they were talking about how they'd solved it. And I said, well, what plan did you have? And they said, we asked the state for more money, and they gave it to us. We made a commitment when we became a public corporation not to come to the state to ask for money for bailouts. We decided we would have to work within our budget, and frankly, we view our partnership with the state as very important in doing this. So the board intends to be accountable. That includes firing the CEO if necessary to make sure things work and that somebody else can be brought on to make things better if that's indicated. We took a budget cut, which we interpreted to be about $18 million when we became a public corporation. That's, I think, consistent with the 14% Mr. Bender commented on. And we also took our debt with us. We had a fairly substantial debt. And one of the real problems we had at that time was very, very poor facilities. And one of the very important things for us was to get our facilities upgraded so, frankly, we could be a place where people might want to come for care. We borrowed a fair amount of money that time to take care of the deferred maintenance. I might comment that deferred maintenance is a problem not unique to OHSU, but also part of the other state university system institutions as well. We did retain our mission. In fact, I think we've retained it extraordinarily well. That includes education. You're going to hear more from Dr. Halleck on that shortly. Clinical care continuing to be the major safety net for the state. And as the Oregon Health Plan goes through changes and Care Oregon becomes the dominant provider through the Oregon Health Plan, we are the major player in that particular system. The thing that I think is particularly important is that our research program has grown from $14 million per year of awards in 1985, I think that was, to what we believe will be $200 million this year. So if you have this book now, I'd like to sort of refer you to page 4, which has our mission statement on there. This is sometimes a question, what is our mission? We have a 4-part mission that relates to education, clinical care, discovery or research, and community service. And we have adhered to that mission. It looks like this. It's page 4.
Page
4. The next thing that and you don't need to look at this carefully now, but on page 5 under the overview, is really a summary of all our component parts. People know pretty much about the medical school, and they know about OHSU Hospital. I think they are very, very acquainted with the nursing school and the dental school, but we also have another number of other units that are important. One is the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center, which works statewide for children with special health care needs, and a variety of other smaller units that provide services around the state. These are delineated here, and again, I want to comment on something that you heard earlier. The nursing schools that are located around the state are all part of OHSU. So the ones that are headquartered in Klamath Falls at OIT, in Eastern Oregon at LeGrand, and in Ashland at Southern are all part of the OHSU nursing school, and the other campus being the one in Portland. On page 11... Actually, turn to page 12, if you would. This shows a little snapshot of our changes over the years between 1975 and today. And it gives you a look at our operating budget, the percent of support from the state, which was 42% at that time, our grant awards, which were relatively small in 1975, the number of employees and the number of students. 1995 was the landmark year of the Senate Bill 2 passage that allowed us to develop Oregon Health Sciences University as a public corporation, and you can see that since that time we have grown approximately 3,500 employees, even though we took a cut And our budget is a little bit misleading in that some of the things that show in our gross budget are frankly pass-throughs to some of the programs that are important to the state. Now, this research growth, which you'll hear about more tomorrow or Wednesday, really is the key to why the Oregon opportunity, I think, is so important for the state. On page 15 is another table that's similar about who pays for OHSU and what it does. It has some similar numbers on there, but again, I think if you take a look at state support, relatively flat, actually lower than it was in 95, the gifts, grants, and contracts have grown from $15 million in 1975, $110 million just in 1995, to over $250 million this current in the year 2000. Interestingly enough, patient care revenues have increased substantially, but they have not grown nearly to the same extent. Frankly, our facilities are so full right now that we're on divert most of the time. We have a very serious problem with having adequate capacity to take care of the people who want to come to OHSU. And finally, the last thing I'd point out in this book is on page 22, sort of our chronology. I think the latest piece of that, which is important to especially note, is the merger with Oregon Graduate Institute that you have already passed, and the governor has signed into law creating Oregon Health and Science University, which we think is going to be a very critical part of the state's future. Now, coming back to what's happened here, we have stabilized our clinical programs, and we've striven for excellence in all the areas that we do. I think that one of the things in which we have truly achieved tremendous breakthroughs is in the area of research. And if you looked at yesterday's paper, the article on Brian Druker and his cancer pill, truly an extraordinary breakthrough in terms of the approach to cancer. We can have more things of that type, and I want to talk about that more in the future when we talk about the Oregon opportunity, but this creates great value for us. The other thing is by the mergers that have occurred since we became a public corporation, first with the Oregon Regional Primate Center, then with the Neuroscience Institute from Legacy, and finally with Oregon Graduate Institute, we have really created quite a powerful research and educational institution. Our rankings, and you hear a lot about rankings, are quite high in certain areas. Our nursing school is one of the top in the country. It rates, for example, number 5 in NIH grants to nursing schools. Our primary care program, and I think Senator Duncan, that's the thing that people are aware of around the state, nationally is ranked this year under U.S. News and World Report as number 2. In terms of the grants from NIH, which is a way we measure ourselves against other institutions, we rate either number 28, 29, or 34, depending on the comparator. Number 34. 34 would be all more than 2,000 institutions that receive support. 29 would be all academic higher education institutions, and 28 would be the medical schools. Again, we have other schools that bring in money as well. Now, we would like, you have heard that the budget, it's a little confusing because there's $10 million both in the Oregon Opportunity funded by tobacco money, and there's $10 million which was rolled up and cut back from our base budget. We would like to speak as we go through this testimony today about our state budget. We will live whatever the budget is, but we do see ourselves being in a partnership with the state, particularly in the areas of education and the safety net function, Representative Lowe, that you alluded to. We are highly leveraged at 6.7% of our budget coming from the state now. Remember, our budget is closing in on a $1 billion-a-year budget, and 50-some million dollars is a great deal of money, but percent-wise, it's relatively low. We will adjust our programs however we need to stay out of financial trouble. That's one of the promises that was made to the state. And if we are cut to $10 million on our base budget, we will certainly cut our programs to fit that, and you'll hear more about that later. Our board, nor do I think it's appropriate, to carry more program than we can afford. I think there are several reasons to believe that health education is more important now than it has been perhaps any time in the recent future, at least. Nursing is in a national crisis. The workforce is aging. We have inadequate numbers of faculty to even teach nursing school, so if the community colleges want to expand their programs, they don't have adequate numbers of faculty members. Think of OHSU as the institution that educates the teachers who then can teach the faculties in the other nursing schools. That's part of what we do. So I think it's critically important that nursing not become a bigger problem in this state. Dentistry has an aging workforce. We are not quite at the critical level yet in dentistry, but we are getting to that point where I think dentistry will have a problem. And I can tell you that because of the aging of the population, all the workforce projections that were done, many under the auspices of the Pew Foundation about 10 years ago, are turning out to be wrong. We are wrong right now in terms of the numbers of medical specialists we need. For example, we just recruited a new chair of OB-GYN at OHSU. She is a gynecologic oncologist, fortunately, and as she pointed out to me, there are not enough around of these after the Pew report came out and the training programs were cut back. Medical school is also critical to the staffing of our hospital and our clinical programs and our clinics. So this provides us with not only the teachers, but the workforce as well. We have the Child Development Rehabilitation Center program. It provides care for children with special needs all around the state. That's one that is also matched up against a federal grant, and I think one that's critically important. We have many other, the Poison Control Center, AHEC, Office of Rural Health is part of OHSU now. That's something the state gave us some time ago that we think is very important in carrying out our statewide mission. These are all important programs that the state could suffer.
I'm just curious. I'm just trying to think where the center in Elgin. I believe in Elgin.
The clinic in Elgin?
Yeah. Now, what is that a part of?
That's part of our nurse practitioner teaching program. Okay. That's staffed by the faculty that are out of Eastern Oregon University, as is the clinic in Union as well. And I think as we look at the future of where healthcare is going, that type of clinic arrangement is going to be very important for the Medicaid population in the future. These are things that we're looking at.
Because they're not going to be able to afford physicians in those areas.
The population will not support a physician. Yeah. That's right.
Dr. Carr, in terms of, you made several references to the reduction in the governor's budget of $10 million in general funding, and then you've alluded to what may occur. I guess my question is, what will occur so that this committee understands what the choices that will be made rather than a list, you know, a sort of a Chinese menu of you know, well, we could go off and do these things, and so we could choose the best cuts or the worst cuts, but it seems to be we don't know what choices that the board would make given this determination. Has there been discussions by the board in terms of where they would make cuts?
Indeed there has, and these will be presented to you by Dr. Halleck and Mr. Walker, unless you want me to go through some of them now, but they're going to do that for you, and I know that that's an important part of your decision-making process. I just want to close my overview comments by saying I think OHSU, now OHNSU, has been extremely successful. The public corporation saved us from disaster, literally. It's been a major step forward. It's put us in a position to be much stronger and of much more value to the state. Clearly, we can be an economic engine, and I believe that diversifying the economy with biotechnology is an important step job-wise all around the state. And you'll hear more about that when we talk about the Oregon opportunity. But I think to continue to move forward, we need to be sure that we are acting prudently within our capacity, frankly, to carry out our mission-based programs, namely education and safety net. We see research as needing to sit on its own bottom, and we provide community service as part of our education. But these are the programs that I think are at risk this time around with budget cuts. So we would like, of course, to return the $10 million that's been cut back from the rolled-up budget, and you'll hear reasons why this is important. And I would like to turn this over now to Dr. Halleck to talk about our educational programs, unless there are other questions.
Are there any questions for Dr. Carr?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess we all know that nursing shortage is a critical concern, and I want to know why the enrollment of nurses have not increased to match with demand of the state and community. It looks like they have been declining. So I want to know what is the enrollment figure you have currently, and what is your projection for the next 2 to 5 years?
If this is acceptable to you, Senator Yee, Dr. Halleck intends to cover that in her presentation. She has specific numbers that relate to the increases. You will recall that last session we did get some special help for nursing and for dentistry, and that has been incorporated, but it's relatively recent. She'll be able to cover that for you if that's okay.
For my presentation, I will be working from a series of slides that are in a packet that look like this. It says OHSU Educational Programs that I believe
you
all
know. Can you identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Leslie Halleck. I'm the provost at Oregon Health Science. Health Sciences University, or Health and Science University, as we're all learning to say. I want to just give you a brief framework of the next couple of days so you know where we're headed. Today, I'm going to give you an overview of the educational programs at OHSU. Most of the public investment of the state appropriation is either in the educational programs or the subsidy of health care to those who don't have access otherwise. Those are really the two areas where the state dollars go. I'll be talking about the educational programs today. Tomorrow, Mr. Jim Walker will give you an overview of our entire budget and include the hospital finances, the impacts of the proposed budget cuts on those finances and on the institution as a whole. And I will come back and give you very specific answers to the question that the chairman has raised and that Senator Yee has mentioned in terms of the impact of the budget cuts in the past and in the future on specific programs. On Wednesday, then, we will talk about the Oregon Opportunity, the program, and the financing of it. And then it's up to you what you do with all that, of course. But just so you knew the framework, I wanted today especially emphasize the educational programs where approximately 80% of the state dollars are found. If you look at the first slide, which is page 1 in your slide packet, it gives you an overview of the different students that are currently enrolled at OHSU, and you can see that they are in 3 schools, a number of allied health programs, and then a number of postgraduate training programs. And I'll be going through the schools one by one as we go through this and describing briefly some of the high points that characterize those programs. But this gives you a sense of the kinds of health professionals and researchers that we are training. And we can come back to this in specific detail. A word about the allied health and the trainees, because I will be focusing primarily on the schools after this. If you look at our enrollment, and you will in a moment see the numbers, our enrollment's fairly steady. It's fairly constant relative to higher education institutions. Typically, if it changes, it's because we did something to change a program. We added a program or we eliminated a program. And the physician assistant program, for example, in the Allied Health group is a new program. And those are new students because it met a specific need of providing mid-level providers to the state. You will see in the trainee group a fairly large number of individuals who are just out of their educational experience and gaining the additional experience they need to do whatever they've been trained to do. In the case of the interns and residents, you're all familiar with those. That group spends approximately 4 years in training following the receipt of the MD degree before they're really independent practitioners. The postdoctoral fellows you may not be as familiar with, those are research trainees who have completed a PhD in a specific area, in our case a biomedical research area typically, who are receiving, again, additional training and work usually on a fellowship, often from the federal government, in a research laboratory. If you look at the next page, and you probably can't see this on the screen, but in front of you, you can see the enrollment as it has been tracked since 1994-95, the year before the public corporation. And I show you this in part because as a pact with the legislature when the public corporation was formed, we agreed to provide a report of certain parameters or outcomes that measure us as an educational institution so that the legislators could see what they were buying with this grant and who you were training. And I think you can see, if you look at the bottom line, that our enrollment has grown somewhat. But if you really look through this table, you'll see that that growth is mostly attributed to a couple of things. The addition of the physician assistant program, which I already mentioned, and the growth in a couple of areas, such as the graduate program in medicine. If you look at that program, the numbers have increased from 200 to 350. Those numbers plot right on a curve with our research growth. Those are individuals who are working in research environments who go out and start companies or become independent researchers, and they are not funded by the state, incidentally, but funded by fellowships and grants. And so those are, that's another place for where the enrollment has grown. But if you look at dentistry, medicine, the professional degree, the nursing programs, they've really been relatively constant. And I will come back to Senator Yee's question in very specific terms year by year when I come to the School of Nursing, because that's a pretty complicated story, and I want to make sure that that's understood. Mm-hmm. If you look at the next... I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Yee.
From the chart, it shows on page 2, seems to me there's a real decline.
Right.
From 94. And you say you explain this later.
I will. I can give you just a glimpse now. One of the things that occurred is during the Measure 5 cuts, we did reduce the class size. When we received the same cuts that all of higher education received, which were basically 15, 20, and 10% cuts in the three biennia, we actually cut some of the enrollment, although we did not cut it in rural areas, we cut it in the Portland metropolitan area, but we did sustain some class size cuts. Those cohorts are now recovering, but as you remember from Mr. Bender's presentation, our budget has really been flat since then until the last biennium when we received $4 million, which was specifically earmarked for both nursing, dentistry, and the AHEC programs. None was awarded to medicine. And in that program, in the nursing edition, we ramped up the class size again, and you'll see in a couple of minutes when we get to the enrollment data that they've begun to climb in nursing. Of course, it takes them a while to graduate, but we've begun, the enrollment has started to climb because of that additional resource that we had from the last session.
Do you have something that we can see sort of the relationship to the funding dollars in terms of and the programs? I mean, we just see numbers here.
Right.
And trying to understand in terms of how we tie it back. I don't know what decisions, because we're giving block grants to the university, and someone then makes a decision that says, I'm going to dice those dollars up into specific programs. And we've got what DAS did. I mean, is that an
accurate
picture?
We will give you those specifics, and you'll see most of the numbers tomorrow in the budget presentation. But in summary, the allocations to the different programs remain the way they were when the state gave us those allocations. We haven't rearranged the state dollars and taken them from one school and given them to the other. The only change that's occurred is because it was flat funded, of course, there's been a decline if you consider inflation. And then in the last session, we were given additional money that was specified for specific programs, and that has been added to those programs, and you'll see that tomorrow. So it isn't that we divide it differently each year. They've really been historically maintained in terms of the state dollar.
So what is the, sort of what's the easy answer or the hard answer in terms of how you increase enrollment to address the need out there, in a semi-independent public corporation status in terms of, I guess, what is OHSU doing to roll other dollars into this to match the general fund dollars to increase capacity?
Well, we'll show you some of the things we've done, but there is a limitation to what you can do, and it depends on fundraising, it depends on raising tuition. In fact, if you look at the next page, number 3, you'll see the history of the tuition. an easy answer on paper is to raise tuition. It's not an easy answer when you come to public policy because it very much affects who can become a health professional. But if you look, you can see that even just since 94, 95, and if you went back to 1990, this curve would be much steeper, you will see the increases in the medical school, the yellow bars there, to a very high level of tuition, $18,000 a year. That tuition is about fifth highest in the country for public medical schools. Dental schools are probably about 10th or 11th this year, which we don't know what people will do, so you're projecting against the previous year, but they're still very high for public institutions. But you can see that nursing school tuition hasn't risen at the same rate. It's certainly risen, however, in order to balance the budget in the face of a flat state dollar. So one piece of the answer is that we've shifted more of the burden to the students. It's not something we want to do, but that it's the same thing that's happened overall in education. Another piece is that we've done fundraising, significant fundraising.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you. Can you please tell me when you became a private or a public corporation and no longer agency of the state, but a public corporation, was that about the time that you guys began to enjoy the protection of the tort cap limitation?
No, that's always been part of the public entity that we were when we were a state agency as well. Mm-hmm. So that hasn't changed.
No, it hasn't changed, but your building program has increased substantially since you became a corporation and not an agency of the state.
Right.
So has anybody done any math or done any calculating to see what the economic impact, the economic benefit that the state has given to you by allowing you to continue to have that tort cap limitation, that protection from being catastrophically sued? Because I'd kind of like to have a feel for where that state money went, if it went back into state programs that we are asking you to provide, or if it went into bricks and mortar, or if it went into administrative salaries or research, or where'd that money go? I'd like to know that.
One thing, we can give you the exact amount that insurance would cost if we had to purchase malpractice insurance rather than the tort limitation, but it hasn't changed, so we didn't have that money before, we didn't have to pay it before and then save it by not having to pay it.
At a similar institution your size, hospitals haven't grown at the rate that you guys have grown. They haven't had the responsibilities that you have had to meet. But I would like to kind of, maybe tomorrow when you come in, I'd sure like to have some of that budget information so that we can see what we're getting for that protection that we're giving you. And maybe if we take a look at some of these programs, indigent care and education function, we might take a look at it from that aspect.
Sure. And we can show you those numbers in the context of the budget tomorrow and be happy to do
that. I'd be grateful to see that. Thank you, Dr.
Representative Petridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the kind of the snapshot on page 2. That's helpful, but I'd be interested to know how many of these people, what your postgraduate survey stuff is showing. And I tried to look ahead in the packet, and maybe I glanced over the top of it, but I was trying to figure out what your postgraduate surveys are saying at maybe, I don't know how often you're doing them, 3 years, 5 years out, where are they practicing? Are they practicing in Oregon? Are they practicing? I saw that 40% of the physicians are from Oregon, but what about the nurses that we're training? What about all the other healthcare professionals, and what's the track look like? I'd be interested in seeing how our state money is being spent and incentivizing those. I just ran a task force bill out this morning on healthcare employment this morning. So
we'll be happy to share that. We can give you, and there's some other statistics in here, In medicine, you have to, it depends on whom you're looking at. The MDs typically are between 40% and 50%. The residents are higher than that. They tend to be around 2/3 of the residents trained here, in fact, stay here. And that just has to do with when you go into a residency, as you get out of medical school, very often you move to a different institution. It's not uncommon for people to settle in the areas to which they've moved. So if you look at the residency numbers, they're around 60%. If you look at nursing, it's very high. We have numbers, and particularly the rural areas, that show that as high as 90%, sometimes even higher depending on the year, of the nurses trained in those sites stay in those areas, which is why the training in situ is so effective. In dentistry, the last data, and I had this morning actually, show that of the licensees in Oregon, 2/3 of them trained at OHSU. So it's kind of the reverse of what you're saying, but the majority of dentists in the state have been trained at OHSU. We have survey data as well, which I can share with you.
I'd just be interested in your survey data compared to your degree rate.
Sure.
To say what's, you know, whatever you have that's convenient.
Where do they
just
stay?
Just helpful for us to know those things. You know, all these people I know who graduated from your institution still stayed in the state, but they were from the state, and I don't know what's happening for those who are outside of the state right now.
We'll be happy to provide those.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Yee. I'm interested to know, what does it cost the state to educate the students in dentistry, in medicine, in nursing, and how much of it is paid by tuition, and how much is state subsidy, and also how much is paid by resident students, and how much paid by out-of-state students? Do they pay the full cost of training?
There are several questions there. We have all that data in the budget tomorrow, and I can pull some of it forward if you like. The numbers roughly are very different for the different schools. Mm-hmm. If you look at the nursing school, approximately 40% of the cost of the education is paid for by the state. If you look at dentistry, it's more like 30, and if you look at medicine, it's quite low now, and it's probably around 11, as I recall. And we'll show you the figures on that. The actual cost, the total cost, is much greater, as you can see from the percentages. So it ranges from $25,000 a student to $60,000 a student, depending on the kind of student. And the higher the cost, actually, the lower the percent the state pays, and the higher the percent the tuition covers. The question that you ask of whether out-of-state students cover their full costs, they certainly cover far more than the state full costs, but we also supplement it to some extent where we can with endowments, for example, and private resources if we can obtain them, particularly in the form of scholarships and ways we try and help students to alleviate some of the burden. But those are very minimal. For the most part, the burden is borne by the student in the form of student loans. And particularly in the medical school, the average indebtedness of a student leaving is almost $100,000. So it's very high. In nursing, it's much lower. And again, if you plot those data, they're very close to the entry-level salaries that individuals can obtain in terms of their proportionality. But it is a heavy debt burden that students
Mr. Chairman, I would be interested in seeing a breakdown.
Certainly.
Of all the students. Now, you mentioned that you give scholarships to the out-of-state students. Why do you give scholarships to
out-of-state students? The only out-of-state students that receive scholarships are generally in one of two categories. They're either in a program called the MD-PhD program, which is a national program that's funded by national grants, and it recruits basically the best students in the country to come, and there's a handful of those each year, not very many. The other is sometimes with specific programs, such as a minority recruitment program, there may be targeted scholarships for those students. So if they're targeted for a very specific kind of student, the student might be from anywhere and it could be out of state. Generally, though, if you look at the numbers, we have a very small percent of scholarships relative to loans, which are federal loans that the students incur.
Representative Lowe? significant countries.
Thank you. Before you became a corporation, do you have figures for that period of time, what additional resources, grants, foundation money, all that stuff, was poured into education and care for the indigent? And then after you became a corporation, let us have some trending information on that, because I want to see what you're putting in the pot, too.
Happy to do that. On all the graphs I've shown, I started the year before we became a public corporation to try and give you a hint of that. In the report we gave last year, we went back a few more years, so we'll be happy to give you that whole trend. But basically, we haven't changed the way we've either admitted students or distributed the resources between the schools. We've had less of them in inflation-adjusted dollars, so we've had to raise more of the money in other ways or reduce the program. And to date, we haven't had to reduce the programs very much. But beginning this year, if we sustain this reduction, we will have to reduce the programs. I'll be showing you those numbers tomorrow.
Who's in the second?
Hey, Mr. Chair. Just Steve did some quick math for me that I couldn't believe it, so I double-checked, but Steve's absolutely right, so I should have listened to him to begin with. I mean, if you just took their raw numbers, the $73 million that's in the LFO report on page 22, and you divided that by the students, I know they're, I mean, it's obviously different based upon the subsidy of students in terms of the intensity of their program, but they have, you know, 1,906 students, and you divided that over a biennium, you know, if you just do raw calculations, it's less than $20,000 a student a year, which I think is probably, looking over at the institution across the street that Senator Duncan had to write a check on for his daughter, and I know that I had to, my parents wrote checks on, I wrote checks on, and I think it's probably a pretty good investment.
I can't remember which building I paid for.
I heard they're going to put your name on one.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just if you're running wrong numbers, just to think about the investment that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very small.
They give. It's a very small amount compared to the cost of putting a degree program on.
And just to illustrate the difference one last time between resident and non-resident, the two pages 3 and 4 show, in very simplistic terms, it's about double to 2.5x. For a non-resident to attend. That's approximately the difference. If you look on page 5, and I'm going to skip over several of these because I'm not sure how long you're going to let me.
Let me ask a question here and give you sort of a math assignment.
Sure.
I'm just in rough terms, you know, I'm calculating probably like maybe 70 to 80% increase in tuition from 94 for medical students, maybe a 60% increase for dentistry and 30 for nursing, but I'm equating that back to enrollment in terms of, and so we see an increase in medical students, we see relatively flat for dentistry and decline for nursing. I'm trying to equate in terms of how to affect those trends in terms of we have increases but yet, you know, decline, as sort of the proportionate, you know, ability of someone to, recoup the investment in the education.
Right.
In terms of, you have to be mindful of that. I'm just trying to understand in terms of what the relationship is to those increases back to some historical in terms of, you know, why did we basically almost double medical tuition in this period of time, and then, you know, is that to increase capacity, or is that historically in terms of the raw costs of the subcomponents of that education have increased versus these other schools?
Well, it's really pretty simple. We've increased the medical school tuition at a greater rate than dentistry, which is a greater rate than nursing, because the quality of the program allows us to do that with the market. And so, as you'll see, if you go, let's just go to page 7 and look at the dental school. We have 759 applications last year for 70 slots. The quality of the school is such that we could push the market, frankly, on tuition to cover some of those costs that weren't covered because we didn't see any inflationary increases. In nursing, first of all, the earning potential isn't as great. The need is great, and mindful of not wanting to reduce the class size, and we'll come to those. I don't want to sort of skip around too much here, but we really work to keep tuition down in nursing. And frankly, for years, we kept it exactly at the rate of the higher ed undergraduate tuition. We, without the increases since 95, we weren't able to sustain that, so they've come up higher than undergraduate tuition at an OUS institution. But we've still made every effort to keep those as low as we possibly could. The capacity hasn't changed that much, so what we've done is not raise it any more than we had to sustain what we had. And you'll see in a minute the medicine effect is even more dramatic.
Well, and that's what I'm trying to jump back, sort of then tying that to the to what Dr. Kohler was talking about, the trends in terms of here, the Pew research, which is wrong,
mm-hmm.
in terms of, and so now, you know,
you're not jumping in here
right
a second.
People that we're trying to look to say, how are we going to drive these trends? We know that we have a, you know, shortage of nurses, and how do we address that, you know, from a public policy standpoint, and then from an educational standpoint.
Right. This is a subject of much concern right now at the national level. In-state here, the Northwest Health Foundation has recently done a study on the nursing shortage, which is very useful. But part of the problem, it has not been a very attractive career option. And I think the concern of nursing school deans has been not to raise the tuition to the point where it's a deterrent to people matriculating in nursing. But there are several component parts to the reason that nursing is not more popular. First of all, there are alternative careers to many people who would otherwise have gone to nursing. It has still not drawn many men into nursing, although there are some. And frankly, the lifestyle in nursing is quite grueling, and the length of time as a practicing nurse tends to be shorter than in other professions because there's so much heavy duty involved. So there's a lot of thought going on right now. How do we make nursing a more attractive profession so that we can get more people into it, because the need is going to just be greater and greater. Tuition lower, I think, was a response to not scaring people off from nursing who might otherwise come.
Mm-hmm. If you...
Excuse me. Maybe she's continuing to answer your question. Is that...
No, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I just had a quick question on the... percentage passing the boards the first time. Obviously, it looks very good for dentistry and probably good for the others, too. But I'm just wondering, the elective medicine, quite an investment there, and you have about 5.5% or so not making it. What happens? Do they make it the second time around?
Yes. In fact, typically, we never have more than one, if one, who doesn't make it the second time around. So we were trying to be scrupulously consistent here and just do first-time takes. It is not uncommon, particularly for a student in a very heavy set of rotations in the spring, not to devote the time to assure that they will pass it the first time, but to do it in the summer, and then they pick it up in the fall. But typically we have either zero or one who don't make it, and the one usually does the following, the third take, if there's any, and this last year there weren't. So it is, and if you look at that curve on page 5, remember, the scale starts at 84%, and you can see on the bottom the national averages, and we're well above the national average on
it's
all
very
of them.
Impressive.
If we could skip, I already talked to page 7, and I'm going to skip page 6, which you can look at. It really just delineates the actual numbers of graduates. But want to draw your attention to page 8, which is another indicator of quality for the School of Dentistry. We're starting the specific schools now, and here, what you probably are aware is students going into these schools have to take these very rigorous exams, and they're extremely competitive. We have 700 applicants for 70 spots. This gives you the increase in the average scores on those exams of the students who come against the national average. And if just to further confuse you, if you skip down to page 11, you'll see a similar comparison for what are called MCAT scores in the School of Medicine. And again, you see that the quality of applicant in the applicant pool continues to rise at OHSU, and it's remarkably competitive. Let me take you now to
page... Mr. Chair, Dr. Halleck, that's very interesting. Out of a score of 45, I mean, I realize the scales, but boy, those 10... That just seems like a very low figure. I mean, I'm just more curious about it than I am questioning it.
Actually, that's very misleading because there's several parts to it, and those are average scores on each part.
On each part.
Uh-huh.
That would make a difference.
Yeah.
I was hoping my doctor had...
yeah.
I mean...
Good catch. Yeah, the footnote should have it divided there because it's really a perfect score is, I believe, 11. Isn't that right, Pete?
On each one of them.
On each part.
Oh, okay.
So, and you can see where the national average is, which is 9.9, which would be even worse.
Well, yes, I...
if I could take you to page 9, and this is the School of Dentistry points for the poor person trying to keep up with me on the PowerPoint there.
45 to 11.
Yes.
On page 9, I've just listed two or three of the main points about the School of Dentistry that I want you to note. Part is the what we've already discussed in terms of their pass rates and their scores. Their GPA entering are typically in the handful, always the top 10 in the country, so we have a very well-qualified student body. I have to read you a letter that I received this morning to show you how diverse these students are. And a physician who did allow his name to be used by the name of Jack Shunk, who's a pediatrician, was playing tennis recently and had a heart attack. And he was a fourth-year dental student, intervened and administered CPR. He had no pulse when she began. And even after the paramedics came and his pulse had been regained, he lost it again. And the same dental student intervened again, and he's writing a thank you letter, basically, and also a plug to keep the mandatory CPR requirement in the dental school. At any rate, the students are extremely sharp and very well prepared. The other thing to keep in mind about the dental school is that they actually practice in school a great deal, 2 to 3 times the average amount of procedures over most dental schools. So they leave school ready to start drilling in your teeth. They're very well practiced by the time they graduate. I'm sorry.
Thank you. I apologize for interrupting you, Dr., but I want to know about the pediatric dental chair, what the status of that is, and whether or not there's a move to restore it. I think that that's a pretty important program, and since our dentistry school is so phenomenal, I'm shocked that we haven't taken the steps to see that restored.
We would love to have the resources to do that. We've applied for federal grants to do that. We are recruiting and think we have recruited a new person to lead the pediatric dentistry program. But there's two programs that you look at. One is the pediatric dentistry program within the dental school, and the other is a residency program for postgraduate training. If we're really going to address the needs long term in the state, we need both. But the first step of that is making sure you have very good pediatric training within the what's called undergrad, which is deceptive because they're really after baccalaureate, but within the dental program, and that's what we're doing now. We do not have the resources in hand to build a graduate program on top of that at this time, and so that's where we are now.
Do you have a plan?
It's a function of the funding, frankly.
Is there a plan to restore it?
There is a plan to restore it, and it's really a question of whether we have the base on which to build it. But you can't build pediatric dentistry unless you have a strong overall dentistry program, because the person who's going into pediatrics has to know all the basics first. And one of the interesting things, in spite of all the quality marks I've given you about the program, is that it is the bottom in the country in ratio of faculty to students. And it runs between 1 and 2 in the country. So it's a very thinly staffed situation. And we're right on the edge. It's amazing what they accomplish. But we're trying to get that built to where we have the base on which to build such a program. But we do think we've just recruited a wonderful chief, so we're making progress in that arena. I mentioned a little bit about medicine. I just will point out one number to make sure you see it on page 10. The number of applications in the fall of 2000 was 2,653 for 96 spots. 2,600 for 96. So it gives you a sense of how hard it is to get into medical school and why those scores are so high in the incoming class. The School of Medicine has been ranked very highly, particularly in primary care arenas, but also in many of the other areas. And President Kohler already mentioned that in this recent U.S. News and World Report, we've actually moved from third to second in our ranking in primary care in the country. So they're well regarded. I want to be
sure.
Yes.
Can you tell me how we compare to other states our size and the number of physician slots that are available in Oregon versus other states?
You know, it's all over the map. The average size is larger than ours in terms of students, and it's closer to 150 or so, even in smaller states, particularly states with only one medical school. There are many that have 200 or multiple medical schools. So I would say it's on the small size in terms of physicians produced per population. We've not attempted to grow that simply because we haven't had the resources to do it. One could argue that that capacity would be very valuable. And right now, they're looking at the curriculum to see if there's any way to enhance our capacity, even by a few students. But to date, there's so much one-on-one training that goes on in the medical school that, the ratio of faculty to students becomes very critical there. But it's on the small side, and we can give you that whole distribution if you'd like to see it. I want to be sure and touch on nursing before we leave today, and I have a sense you're going to stop me before too long, but if you could look at the pages 13 and on, it gives you, and particularly page 14, and that might be the easiest way to describe the map, and the following page, which gives you the enrollment data of the various programs. The nursing schools around the state are all under the auspices of the Oregon Health Science University School of Nursing, and they have multiple programs. There are a series of baccalaureate programs on all four of the main campuses, Portland, of course, Eastern, OIT, and Southern. Those are the red dots on the map. There are a large number also of baccalaureate programs that are called RN to BS, or sometimes degree completion programs, which are really addressing students who've graduated from an associate preparation, an RN that they obtained in one of the 16 associate colleges in the state. And we enhance that education and do a combination of, I tease the nursing school and say they have circuit riders. There's a large number of ways that those students are trained. Some come to the campus, some are trained where they work. And in addition, we have now graduate programs that are also scattered around the state, and you can see those in the yellow triangles here and the blue triangles to give them additional preparation. And the nurse practitioner licensure in this state requires graduate training. So for independent practitioners, that distribution and getting that out into around the state was very critical.
So does 100% of the funding for all of these programs flow through OHSU, or any of these sub-programs will have funding going through the OUS budget that will go to the programs?
It is almost 100%. The exception to that is that each of the three regional campuses received approximately $50,000 each for student support. It's approximately $300,000 in the biennium. That, my understanding is that that's been cut from the budget in the governor's budget. I don't know the current status of it, but that's a pretty critical piece for them, because that gives the campuses support to take those students on their campus and into their campus life. But with the exception of that, all the funding flows through OHSU. Some of these programs are more driven by tuition. Others are driven more with the state. The main baccalaureate programs have the largest component of the state dollars in them.
Is that happy?
I just asked the same question that I asked on the physicians compared to our population. Low, high?
Very high. Much higher than the physicians, in fact, because they don't have to go into a residency program where they go all across the country. So most of the nurses stay in Oregon, probably between 80 and 90%.
No,
most
nurses by population.
Oh, well, you're going to see it's very dramatically low, actually, when we come to the shortage in terms of what's needed, and particularly as you project out. But it's low even by
compared to other states.
Compared to other states, it's probably on the low side, but the shortage is a national issue.
I understand that.
The production is low. The shortage is not as acute in Oregon as it is in other states yet because it's an attractive place to live, but it's coming.
Mr. Chair, and Dr. Halleck and Dr. Fuller, I'm just curious. I know we talk about engineering and teaching in some of those areas where the private schools are very involved too. And I know I've asked PSU and others about, okay, what's the relationship like the University of Portland with the School of Engineering? And I guess I would ask the same kind of a question of you as I look at nursing. And I think that's the only private school. Is there another one?
Another, Linfield.
Linfield. Gee, I went to Linfield too. Linfield and the University of Portland. I wonder, is there any working relationship at all? Is there any advantage as we look at the needs in Oregon and where maybe you can help them and they can be of assistance to you? I don't know.
There's actually quite a bit going on right now, particularly because of the shortage. All the different institutions and really the community colleges as well are looking at the curriculum at its very base and whether it can be taught in a more efficient way so the production can be ramped up. That's a national issue that's being investigated, and it ranges and the privates are involved in that as well. And they're looking at things like simulated models. Can you do that and therefore need fewer instructions and then do final tests on people? But and that's just one example, but there's a lot of work going on now in collaboration with the privates and the associate degree programs.
And Mr. Chair, I have one other question, and I don't know with your budget restraints and so forth. I just want to, is there any connection with some of the other health-related kinds of programs? And I'm thinking of optometry school at Pacific, the physical therapist school there, I believe. I don't even know where you go to the chiropractic school, because sometimes there's some connections nowadays that didn't used to exist, maybe, and even naturopathic. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. Is there any relationship or connection or anything going on in that area in this state?
There's a great deal of research interaction and collaboration. In addition, with respect to University of Pacific, we actually train many of their physical therapists in their practical experience component of their curriculum. So they'll have their classroom at University of Pacific, and then they'll come into our rehabilitation center for some of their practical experiences. There's the optometry dean that recently left University of Pacific was actually a family practitioner, interestingly enough. And so he had a faculty appointment in our family medicine department, and there was a lot of interaction with family medicine. So it's sort of program specific, but there are a large number of those interactions across the state.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make sure that we look at enrollment very briefly. If you look at page 16 before we do, you'll see the School of Nursing also ranks very highly nationally in terms of its the way that nursing programs are evaluated both at the undergraduate and at the graduate level. And in research, they rank ninth this last year in funding from NIH. All of the master's programs are in the top 10 nationally. And remember, the nurse practitioners are prepared through master's programs in nursing. So we've been blessed with a very high quality program for many years. It continues to build its national reputation both in research and in the graduate arena. And in the undergraduate arena, particularly in the way distribution has been impacted in this state. If you look at the next couple of pages, they begin to really focus on the numbers that Senator Yee was asking about. And you can see that the enrollment for the baccalaureate program since 1995 has really been very constant and has only recently begun to rise. And the reason for that is funding. It's really pretty straightforward. Where the arrow is shown on that curve is where you gave us some additional funds. And when that occurred, we invested in increasing what's that really heavy black line is the targeted admission. So we target how many people we're going to admit according to how many we think we can afford to educate. And we've tracked pretty closely to that. In fact, we usually exceed it. The one year we didn't exceed it, which was the fall 2000, the admissions were low in Klamath Falls. And we've been building that back up. It looks like this coming fall it'll be up again. But the last numbers on there are projected based on the data we have to date. So we haven't been able to increase the class size as much as we would like, but that's strictly limited by funds. We have the capacity to increase it somewhat. And if you look at the next page, on page 18, you see a similar story for the graduate programs, the difference being that in 96, and actually there was an additional reduction prior to that, when Measure 5 reduction occurred, because 40% of that school is funded by the state, that impacted the ability to train those graduate programs, and we had to reduce the target and the enrollment. And when the money was restored, partially restored last biennium, we increased that target enrollment again.
Representative Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Based upon the RN requirements in Oregon, how much more stringent are those requirements than other areas of the country, and how much do they impact the program that Oregon Health Sciences delivers?
The main difference relative to other parts of the country is really in the nurse practitioner licensure. At the undergraduate level, the standards are really set by national criteria. But at the graduate level, this state has always had a very rigorous training for nurse practitioners. On the other hand, they have a broad scope of practice. They write prescriptions. They receive reimbursements. And so the rigorous educational standards are linked with that scope of practice, and so the two go hand in hand. But they are more stringent at the nurse practitioner licensure level than because of the graduate degree requirement.
Okay, we'll stop asking questions and give you 5 minutes to wrap up.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
quickly.
I want to know, what is the prediction for the next 2 years? Your chart stops at 2001 for the nurses. So I would appreciate that information.
Maybe we can answer that better than they could.
Yeah, it sort of depends on the outcome of the hearings, I think. But
at the current funding level.
At the current funding level, it would flatten again, I'm afraid. I mean, we've pushed that capacity as much as we think we can afford to. We may be able to push tuition a little bit, but again, you run into real access problems for students when you do that, in terms of both the applicant pool and the debt load of the students when they leave. You could project out 5 or 10 years. If the shortage becomes an absolute crisis, you could argue that wages will go up, people won't leave the workforce as quickly. But that's a pretty, it's sort of, you have to go through the crisis to get to that solution.
We like the information on the cost for students and the tuition we charge for out of state and in state offers.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. The material at the end is really an overview of the Oregon Graduate Institute. I don't have to do that at this time. It disconnects nicely.
Because my understanding was we weren't going to fund them,
right.
So we don't need to talk about it.
Okay. we'll bring them up again in the Oregon opportunity because they're very relevant to the research agenda. But it's true, there is we are not asking for state dollars for this program. Thank you.
Any last words?
I wonder if it might be worth mentioning place-bound students, because we do everything we can for the nursing school, including educating people who can't leave their homes. So we have people getting distance learning around the state, and we know where they are when they finish. They're right there because they can't leave.
Well, a couple of things, and I'd like...
Well, they're learning so they could get out.
Well, you saw the map of all the locations for nursing, and in fact, if you look at page 26, it gives you the map, there you go. This gives you a map that carves the state into areas according to the Area Health Education Center programs, and one of the main goals of that program is really to allow education to take place in the community where the need is greatest. Those are 501c3s, those yellow circles. Those are community boards that drive the needs of those entities and tell us what are the health professional shortages in the area, and then we try and provide educational programs that locate there. We do that through a variety of means that include online curricula. It includes people going out physically to these locations. We partner with whomever is there. If you look at, you might show the network slide, the first network slide. It's not in the PowerPoint presentation, but with all the colors on it, and you don't have a copy of this, but I have a couple of things that depict basically our computer systems, but all the linkages that we have, and this gives, and it's a very technical slide, but it gives basically all the different applications that we've built that are accessible from our network. And if you look at the next one, that they'll show, what we've done is we've connected all the programs on the Hill and off the Hill into a network that includes not just our network, but networks around the country. And I think you were distributed, you received this little pamphlet that says Internet 2. The reason I did this is just purely to brag. This is an NSF national pamphlet that they have funded the development of Internet 2, which is the mechanism for getting lots of data out to lots of people and exchanging it. And what's amazing about this is that our program at OHSU made the first two articles of this national blurb, and inside are small institutions such as Stanford, UCLA, you know, those other folks. But we're really leaders in this arena in terms of developing our infrastructure and then distributing it out so that we can access students that are place-bound. And the nursing map shows what we call the Frontier Program. For an academic officer, this is a dream. We have students in cohorts of two in these small communities that we can actually help obtain a baccalaureate in nursing and practice in the little town where they are place-bound. So it's one of the hallmarks of the nursing program in particular at OHSU. I'll stop again.
Very good. And could you get us copies of those slides?
Yes.
We are the advancing government.
Indeed. I would be happy to get you a copy.
You can just email them to us.
Okay. There you go.
Okay. Any other questions?
I do have one comment, and that is that I know that the Dr. Kohler used other words, but basically we educate a lot of nurses. They stay in the field. We use them up, and they burn out quick. I'm wondering if the nursing shortage could be addressed by doing some sort of reentry program, rehabilitation, reentry, reengaging some of those nurses. I know quite a few folks that have been in that industry who have left it too.
We do some of that now because, as you know, once you're out of nursing for a year or two, the technology has really moved so rapidly, it's hard to get back in. There's lots of machinery to learn about. It's very high tech. Our hospitals are becoming more and more like intensive care units, so you have to really be on top of the technology. We do have some programs to bring people back in, but many people find that daunting. I don't know the numbers that we actually retrain, but we are trying to do that wherever possible.
The RN-to-BS program does actually quite a bit of that because those are nurses, some of them have been working for many, many years, and it's a way for them to go back to school, obtain a higher degree, but also update their skills. And they also bring in, and we just started this program again to address the shortage last year, a program they call the Generic Master's Program. And what that does is really novel around the country. It takes students who have a baccalaureate not in nursing, but in anything else that's relevant if they've met the prerequisites. So typically it's science or biology, but not always. And then gives them an intense dose of clinical training and a master's degree in nursing, even though they didn't have a nursing background to start with. So it brings fresh people, but sort of highly educated ones into the workforce. So there's every level of program being attempted to see which ones work best.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much. We'll see you back here tomorrow. We're back tomorrow. The Ways and Means Committee is meeting tomorrow, 3:30. I'm assuming we'll be back over in E. If it changes, they'll let us know.
In here.
No, E. I believe. Okay. So without objection, we are adjourned.